Translation. Undoubtedly, it is wonderful that Dwarka has defeated the glories of the heavenly planets and has enhanced the celebrity of the earth. The inhabitants of Dwarka are always seeing the soul of all living beings, Krishna, in his loving feature. He glances at them and favours them with sweet smiles. Please repeat. Undoubtedly, it is wonderful that Dwarka... like that smile. Okay, so purport by, of course, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The heavenly planets are inhabited by demigods like Lord Indra, Chandra, Varuna, and Vayu. And the pious souls reach there after performance of many virtuous acts on earth. Modern scientists agree that the timing arrangement in higher planetary systems is different from that of the earth. Thus, it is understood from the revealed scriptures that the duration of life there is 10,000 years by our calculation. 6 months on earth is equal to 1 day on the heavenly planets. Facilities of enjoyment are also similarly enhanced, and the beauty of the inhabitants is legendary. Common men on the earth are very much fond of reaching the heavenly planets because they have heard that the comforts of life are far greater here than on earth. They are now trying to reach the moon by spacecraft. Considering all this, the heavenly planets are more celebrated than the earth. But the celebrity of the earth has defeated that of the heavenly planets because of Dwarka, where Lord Krishna reigned as king. Three places, namely Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwarka, are the most important and famous planets within the universe. These places are perpetually sanctified because whenever the Lord descends to earth, he displays his transcendental activities, particularly in these three places. They are perpetually the holy lands of the Lord, and the inhabitants still take advantage of the holy places, even though the Lord is now out of their sight. The Lord is the soul of all living beings, and his desire is always to have all living beings in their sarup, in their constitutional position, to participate in transcendental life in his association. His attractive features and sweet smiles go deep into the heart of everyone, and once it is done, the living being is admitted into the kingdom of God, from which no one returns. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. The heavenly planets may be very famous for offering better facilities of material enjoyment, but as we learn from the Bhagavad Gita 9:20-21, one has to come back again to the earth planet as soon as the acquired virtue is finished. Dwarka is certainly more important than the heavenly planets, because whoever has been favoured with the smiling glance of the Lord shall never come back to this rotten earth. Rotten earth, he says, which is certified by the Lord himself as a place of misery. Not only this earth, but also all the planets in the universe are places of misery, because in none of the planets within the universe is there eternal life, eternal bliss, and eternal knowledge. Any person engaged in the devotional service of the Lord is recommended to live in one of the four above-mentioned three places, namely Dwarka, Mathura, and Vrindavan. Because devotional service in these three places is magnified, those who go there to follow the principles in terms of instructions imparted in the revealed scriptures surely achieve the same result as obtained during the presence of Lord Sri Krishna. His abode and he himself are identical, and a pure devotee under the guidance of another experienced devotee can obtain all the results, even at present. English again. Undoubtedly, it is wonderful that Dwarka has defeated the glories of the heavenly planets and has enhanced the celebrity of the earth. The inhabitants of Dwarka are always seeing the soul of all living beings, Krishna, in his loving feature. He glances at them and favours them with sweet smiles. Om Agyanam Tididam Dasha Jalankala Shalakaya Taksa Om Miditamena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Titanya Manobistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karamaya Tadapispa Patantikam He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopi Kanta Radha Kanta Ramushtate Namo Om Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Sri Bhutale, Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine, Namaste Sarasvati Devi, Gurvani Pracharine, Nivasesha Shunivadi, Prashachade Satadine, Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Siadvaita Garadha, Siva Sarigur Bhaktivinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Very interesting verse in purport, I think you agree. Prabhupada actually touches on all kinds of matters here. The verse itself is mainly, of course, about the glories of Dwarka and Krishna's mercy and presence within it. But Prabhupada actually talks about the heavenly planets, he talks about the dharms, of course, and even travelling to heavenly planets and also the shortcomings even of the heavenly planets when compared with the holy dharms. Of course, Krishna comes in his original form to this universe from time to time on his transcendental roadshow. And only 5,000 years ago he came to the earth, which is a relatively small period of time. So despite this being a rotten earth, in Prabhupada's words, despite the... let's say that this earth is more or less a middle planet. It's not particularly heavenly, but it's not particularly hellish when compared with the hellish planets, of course. So it's kind of classed as a middle planet in that sense. But it's overall, especially when compared with the heavenly planets, what to speak of the spiritual world, it's pretty rotten. It really is a bad deal for us. It's known as a place of death. It's all around us, even if we try to hide this fact or deny this fact, we can actually see that it's an unpleasant place. Even if we're in a kind of a good situation, it's temporary. And of course, that particularly applies to the heavenly planets. You know, yes, they're very nice, especially compared with the earth, but it's temporary. And that temporariness ultimately makes it a place of suffering, especially when you know your time's running out and you've got to come back to earth again. But anyway, but nevertheless, despite the Earth's relatively, let's say, low ranking of consciousness in the universe, it has been blessed, and we have been blessed, because the Earth was selected by Lord Krishna to appear, to enact his pastimes. And one thing we have to understand, it's not that, oh, Vrindavan came when Krishna came, and Krishna blessed it. Vrindavan is already existing. Dwarka is already existing. Mathura is already existing in the spiritual world, but they descend and manifest in this world. It's not that the historical Vrindavan or Mathura, whatever, the fact that Dwarka sank beneath the sea around after Lord Krishna left the world as part of ending his Leela, if you like. Yes, it's true that Dwarka became unmanifest when it sank beneath the sea. However, it doesn't mean that Dwarka is not here anymore. It's still eternally present, as is all Krishna's abodes in the spiritual world. Simply, they descended with him for his divine Leela, of course. And what's important in our theology also, particularly, of course, in terms of Vrindavan and Mathura, and Vrindavan especially, I think, well, all of them, we cannot distinguish between the holy dharms, but particularly because I suppose Dwarka was out at sea. So it's more difficult to obtain the actual place, although of course there's the city of Dwarka where there's a temple and so forth. But the what may appear to be to the mundane eyes to be a geographical place we call Vrindavan or Mathura or whatever remain as holy dharms and transcendental abodes. We may not have the eyes to see, but those who are serious and practicing spiritual life are able to receive Krishna's mercy by whenever we perform devotional service in these holy dharms, it's magnified. In fact, they also say that anything you do wrong is also magnified, especially in Vrindavan. Mayapur is a different matter, which we can talk about later. So in other words, this is what makes the earth special. So despite the spiritual hurdles, especially in the Kali Yuga, despite these things, the holy dharms are a saving grace. And that's why, as devotees, we should, whenever we can, whenever practical, we should try to visit these places. But Prabhupada actually wasn't necessarily in favor of most devotees coming and staying and residing constantly in Vrindavan, because the offenses can start to build up. you know, and but rather to go there and visit them as place for most of us anyway, as places of pilgrimage to recharge our batteries, to remind ourselves of what it's all about, to get to receive Krishna's mercy. Of course, temples like Bhaktivedanta Manor and many, many temples around the world, all of the temples are embassies to Vrindavan and Dwarka and Mathura. They are the, you have, for example, you might have the American embassy in London or the Mauritian embassy in London or the UK embassy in Washington or whatever. So similarly, the temples established by Prabhupada, well, all these Iskcon temples are essentially embassies of the holy dharms. So again, very special places to, and important places to perform seva, devotional service. However, the three dharms that Prabhupada mentioned, of course, and of course since the time of Lord Chaitanya Mayapur as well, are in a special category of their own. So whenever possible, we should go to the dharms, but in the right mood. It's important that we go in the right mood, because there's entering into a place, and there's really entering into a place in the right mood, and that's how you would receive Krishna's mercy, Krishna's glance, as he used to glance at his at the residence of Dwarka, as mentioned in the verse there. Of course, another important element I think I need to mention is the fact that there are places on earth, in fact there are many places, especially in India, which have links to holy realms. So, you know, a certain town, a certain place, or this is where Nrisimhadev performed this particular leela, or this is where Lord Ram stood, and so forth. So even though, from a historical point of view, the events have been and gone, they remain holy. There remains links, if you like, with the spiritual world, which is a very difficult to understand, I think, from the point of view of our mundane five senses. But we have to understand that the universe we live in is multidimensional. And devotees can understand this concept more, the idea that we're not just dealing with gross matter or which are detectable within our five senses. Rather, the universe has subtle elements and spiritual elements that cannot be necessarily seen or understood by empirical science. And this is a spiritual science. This is the science that devotees, we try to understand, we try to comprehend. And we understand that we can only really understand these things through introducing consciousness into the equation. Otherwise, the holy dharmas can never really be fully understood. It's interesting, actually, that Prabhupada actually also mentions, I thought it was an eyebrow raiser myself, he says, Krishna desires always to have all the living entities in their sarup, in their constitutional position, to participate in transcendental life in his association. So obviously, Krishna is saying, come back to the spiritual world. He wants us to be there. He doesn't want us to suffer in this world of death, in this world of suffering, in this temporary world, this illusionary world, actually, this dreamlike existence. He wants us to be with him. But whenever I see the word sarup, I always try to preach to myself or to remind myself and others. It's not that we can create our own sarup. You know, it will come naturally to us. It's not that we think, okay, that's a good sarup, I'll do that and I'll aim for that. But these things are supposed to manifest to us because it's our constitutional position. So the sarup is the eternal spiritual form is understood to be internally realized after, I imagine, very, very long periods of devotional service and endeavor. And would happen naturally as opposed to artificially or imposed or speculated upon. But of course, Prabhupada also writes in elsewhere in the Bhagavatam that one of the duties of vanaprastas actually, the tradition was, of course, in the Varna and Ashram system, that you would have a married couple, when the children fly the nest, the married couple would then become vanaprastas, which means their duty would be their holidays, perhaps with their children, or perhaps whatever their holidays would be with children, you know, Disneyland or whatever. But if they can afford it. But when they're vanaprastas, their holidays, they should start thinking about the holy dharms. So the idea of the spiritual holidays, you know, you become a place, you live in a place of pilgrimage. If you can even settle in one of the holy dharmas or near a temple, would perhaps be the practical manifestation of that. If one cannot live in the holy dharm in India, one can serve and live near one of the embassies, like one of the temples. That's one of the functions of the temples. And particularly the vanaprastas, who are now semi-retired, if you like, or at least they don't have the children to worry about so much, can start to focus more seriously on their spiritual life and perform service or go on, increase the amount of pilgrimage they go on in the dharms, whether it's a temple or whether it's, you know, Vrindavan and so forth, like that. And when entering into the dharm, Bhaktivinoda Thakur actually writes some rules for us, which I wanted to share with you. Because, as I mentioned before, entering into a dharm as a tourist, as a mundane tourist, as a spiritual tourist is a different matter. As a mundane tourist or someone just there, to make business, for example, is not entering into the dharm. Because the dharm is ultimately a state of consciousness that is revealed to us, of course, in, you know, on the earth. But if we don't go in the right mood, are we may be physically in the dharm, but are we spiritually in the dharm? That's a question, I think, for us. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he actually lists for us, he lists 10 offences, funnily enough, actually, against the holy dharm that we must carefully avoid in order to go and be fully benefited from our visits to going there. I'll quickly run through them because I think they're quite important, because I was talking about the right consciousness and what does it actually mean to enter into a dharm as opposed to a physical place on a map or something like that. Okay, this is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes. Okay, so basically these are things to avoid. To respect one's spiritual master who reveals the dharm to the disciple. To think that the holy dharm is temporary. We touched on that earlier. It is not a temporary physical place. To not commit violence towards any of the residents of the holy dharm or to any of the pilgrims who come there, or to think they are ordinary people. Prabhupada writes, all the inhabitants of Vrindavan are Vaishnavas. They are all auspicious because somehow or other they always chant the holy names of Krishna. So no matter anything else, one should never commit offences to anyone, including the animals, actually. One should not perform mundane activities whilst living in the holy dharm. Do not utilize the dharm for personal economic development by commercializing deity worship and sankirtan in the holy dharm. One should not think the holy dharm belongs to a mundane country or province, such as Bengal. That's obviously referring there to Mayapur. Or to think that the Lord's dharm is equal to a place connected with some demigod, or to attempt to measure the area of the holy dharm. What that would mean is that, for example, someone is saying, oh, okay, well, the district of Vrindavan is so large, and, you know, it was kind of make it, describe it in a mundane geographical, topological sense, I think. To approach it in that way, as opposed to being a spiritual dharm, is offensive to devotees. One should not commit sinful activities whilst residing in the holy dharm. One should not consider Vrindavan Dham as none different from Navadvip Dham. One should not blaspheme the Shastras that assert the glorious position of the holy Dham. And should not be faithless and think the glories of the Dham are imaginary. Prabhupada explained that the results of all devotional activities performed in the holy Dhams are magnified 1,000 times. Therefore, one can make rapid advancement if one lives offenselessly in the holy dharm. However, if we commit offences, the results of those offences are also magnified, especially in Vrindavan. One of the merciful aspects of Lord Chaitanya, actually, is that Mayapur does not accept offences as much as you won't get the same reaction for offences in Mayapur as you would do in other holy places, especially Vrindavan. That's part of Lord Chaitanya's mercy. Mercy upon sinful wretches like myself, in particular. And in the Kali Yuga, that's why, you know, he's the Kali Yuga avatar. And Lord Chaitanya takes into consideration our fallen position and says, well, you know, if there's no dharm for these fallen people of the Kali Yuga, all they're going to do is dump their offences. So we need to, let's have a dharm that is suitable for them. So looking at other aspects here, now going on to the heavenly planet section of Prabhupada's purport here. Papad writes, the heavenly planets may be very famous for offering better facilities of material enjoyment, but as we learn from the Bhagavad Gita 9, 20 and 21, one has to come back again to the earth planet as soon as the acquired virtue is finished. So naturally, let's read what the Bhagavad Gita 20 and 21 says. It reads, those who study the Vedas and drink the Soma juice, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly, says Krishna. They take birth on the planet of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights. Next verse. When they have thus enjoyed heavenly sense pleasure, they return to this mortal planet again. Thus, through the Vedic principles, they achieve only flickering happiness. So basically, this is the Bhagavad Gita, the ABC, if you like, of spiritual life. It's basically straightforward to the point. Is the aim of devotees to go to the heavenly planets? Well, they're not bad places, but they're temporary, and that makes them, in a sense, that makes them bad. Especially if, when you're in the heavenly planets, you're not, you're just enjoying your the reactions of your good deeds on earth. And when that time runs out, yes, by earthly calculation, that may even be hundreds of thousands of years in the very high planets, or 10,000 years, or whatever it may be, which is a long time by our calculation. But it doesn't feel as long when you're actually on the heavenly planet. Because time, as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, time is relative. So the higher you go up in the universe, the more potent the planet is, time is experienced differently. Lord Brahma practically has to only blink and our whole human civilization has been and gone, practically speaking, actually. Prabhupada gives you an example here of the moon. I think it's, what does he say about the moon? It's just one day on the moon is 6 months on the earth. So that's how they experience it. Just so, so for them, it's say you may enjoy the heavenly planets for 10, 20, 100,000 years, which sounds like a good deal. And given the relative enjoyment that is available, whether it's drinking somaras or the association of wonderful people and palaces and kusha grass and pleasures beyond what we can actually imagine, nevertheless, it only doesn't feel like any more than an average lifetime to them. So 20, 100, hundreds of thousands of years by our calculation, you go to the heavenly planets, for them it's just one lifetime, no more than, say, 100 years as it would feel to them. And then if you bodge that up, you come back to the earth again. Oh dear, you've been demoted. So it's not such a great deal. And the sensual, the heavenly distractions in the heavenly planets, the distractions on the heavenly planets, if you think, for example, distractions on this planet are sensual, what to speak of the heavenly planets? So no matter what we may think that someone who's living in Beverly Hills or something like that, or I don't know where it is, Bel Air, I think is the place now, or someone is having a very good situation, very wealthy, they're living a relatively heavenly lifestyle, but the enjoyment experience in the heavenly planets is many, many thousands and millions of times more. So you imagine coming back from that and taking birth after another 10,000 years in the earth. 10,000 years more into the Kali Yuga, 10,000 years past the golden age of Lord Titania. In other words, you end up in the middle of the Kali Yuga somewhere. It's not a good deal. It's not a good deal. So therefore, the earth itself is popular amongst the dead. Prabhupada actually says that there's demigods that want to take birth on the earth just to take birth, for the holy name, to attract the demigods. Because if they're intelligent, if they're pious, they'll think, well, okay, the earth, it's a bit of a dump, frankly. It's a bit of a mess. What are they doing to the earth? I don't know. However, they've got the holy name is there. The holy dharmas are there. And that's the earth's ticket. That's kind of earth's quality. So the demigods are not interested in, and devotees are not interested in the mundane pleasures, whatever little pleasure it is, like a test tube of water in the desert, whatever little bit of pleasure there may be on the earth is certainly of no interest to the demigods. But the holy dharmas, and the embassies of the holy dharmas, and the holy names which have been propagated through the embassies of the dharmas are attractive to the demigods. And thus, Papa said they will start taking, they are already taking birth on the earth. Maybe they're among us today, who knows. But the point is, really, that if demigods are consider the earth to be a special place, even they consider it to be a special place, then we should, you know, we should count ourselves quite very fortunate indeed. So whenever we're in the Dharm or in the temple, let's say, we have to approach it in the right mentality in order to receive the benefit, to actually progress ultimately in our spiritual lives. So just amongst each other, in our own dharms, if you like, you know, in our embassies, we should be careful not to make offences, even if sometimes the devotees deserve it. But but you know, we have to be careful not to make offences. We have to treat the temple as a dharm. Actually, it is a dharm. Prabhupada established these dharms. Whatever there's deities, there's a dharm. There's different things I wanted to point out, actually, about the significance of the earth as well. It's not just, the earth has always been special. We understand just by describing the universe, as in my favorite canto of the Bhagavatam, the fifth canto, which describes the island of Drambudweep and all these different things that we cannot see with our mundane senses, just like we cannot see with our mundane senses, some people may not be able to see things in the Dharma. But nevertheless, they're there, and they can be seen by the demigods. So the demigods see the earth and the universe differently to us, just like we see this room differently to that of an ant or bacteria or something else. Our perception is different. Their senses are more subtle than ours. They can see things that are beyond our senses. Thus, for example, in the fifth canto, it describes the island of Jambudweep, where it appears to be talking about how describing mountains, which correspond with the mountains of Asia, actually, the Himalayas and so forth, they describe them as being, you know, huge places and huge heavenly places all over. However, can we see that? The Pandavas, actually, there's examples of Arjuna, who actually went there to collect celestial weapons from the demigods, of course, which he used in the Battle of Kurukshetra. But we would go, or someone else might go, and someone who's working for National Geographic or something like that would say, yeah, some nice mountains, but demigods, I don't see any. I don't see any heavenly realms. And that's because, obviously, again, just like there's links between the spiritual Vrindavan and, of course, the earth, there's links between the heavenly planets and the earth, too, that we cannot perceive with our five senses. That is my understanding. And I just want to... Okay, so it's 20 past 8. I think you normally finish at 8:30, don't you? Yeah? Even though it's a Kaddishi. Well, Kaddishi, you get a few extra minutes, class. That's the extra austerity. Of course, performing devotional service on a Kaddishi is even more appropriate. There's an interesting part of the purport. Near the beginning of the purport, actually, Prabhupada, it's almost like Prabhupada launches into it, actually. He says... He talks about how the revealed scriptures describe the duration of life is 10,000 years by our calculation and so forth. He talks about that. Then he says, facilities of enjoyment are also similarly enhanced and the beauty of the inhabitants is legendary. Common men on the earth are very much fond of reaching the heavenly planets because they've heard that comforts of life are far greater there than on the earth. We can't argue with that. It says common men on earth are very much fond. They may not be aware of the process, but everybody ultimately wants to go to a better place. And even, I suppose, scientists and so forth are looking out or will be very thrilled. There's actually to find a heavenly planet. I'll give you an example. A few months ago, there was an article in the Daily Telegraph, I think, and it was about, oh, they found a new earth. They've got the Hubble telescope or whatever it is now, the Maha Hubble telescope, and it's looking. They found a planet. They can actually see planets now. Look at their redshift and so forth. And it's very similar to the Earth. It's 95% similar to that of the Earth, and it's bigger. and okay, it's the sea is full of methane, but it's cool, it's okay. We've found a planet, we've found a new Earth, maybe one day in our future. And they usually quote Stephen Hawking or someone like that. They go, one day, thousands of years in our future, mankind will spread across the universe and we'll find all the Earth-like planets and we'll basically chill out there and have a good time. So in other words, consciously or subconsciously, that even empirical scientists and space exploration and so forth, the purpose of it ultimately is to find a new Earth. It's not to find rocks in space and to spend billions of dollars basically just looking at rocks. Ultimately, the biggest thrill would be to find some way of accessing heavenly planets or planets inhabitable for us. Of course, they won't succeed because our bodies are somewhat limited. We live much too short a time. And we don't have a visa. We don't have the qualification to enter into these planets. Or we don't have the senses. We can't, with our bodies, with our five senses, we cannot live on the heavenly planets. We don't have the qualification. We don't have the bodies. But Prabhupada here is indirectly saying that yet common men on the earth, he's talking about NASA and SpaceX and Space Y and Space Z, are ultimately trying to explore the universe from the point of view of their senses, but it's unlikely they will succeed. It says here, they now try, this is probably Prabhupada, especially because it's the first canto, Prabhupada would have written this in the late 60s. It says, they're now trying to reach the moon by spacecraft, which is quite interesting. I wanted to touch on that. Because, of course, according to our theology, the Chandraloka, the moon, is inhabited, a beautiful heavenly planet. And yet, from the mundane point of view, the mundane scientific point of view, well, actually, the moon is essentially grey dust and craters. And on that basis, Balagopal Mataji was talking to me a few weeks ago about this, and she said, well, her husband, Dhananjaya Prabhu, was massaging Prabhupada's head in Baker Street in 1969. And it was quite late at night, I think. And the moon landing was on in 1960, the first moon landing. And Prabhupada was having his head massaged. And basically he said, this is rubbish. You know, they're not on the moon because they can't see people and Kushagrass and Somaras. And, you know, it's not a heavenly planet. It's just a grey place. Turn it off, you know, this is nonsense, you know, and they're fooling everyone. I think then Dhananjaya turned the TV off. And, of course, devotees were shocked by that. Some devotees were doubted Prabhupada at that point. Well, Prabhupada, you know, look, they landed on the moon. No, they're fooling you. Now, there's different ways of addressing this, which I want to touch on briefly, because I find it's an interesting subject. And even quite relevant, because even India now are sending probes to the moon. It's not just NASA now, everyone's up to it. And of course, there's different ways of approaching this. One, of course, is that they've gone to the physical moon, but they haven't entered into the subtle aspect. In other words, they can't see because they're not qualified. They don't, you know, in other words, the heavenly aspect of the moon is beyond our five senses. But if you send probes, or even people, so if they did send people, they wouldn't be able to see because they're only operating within the mundane level. Or it was faked. That's also another possibility, that in terms of humans at least, they couldn't send humans. They didn't have the technology in those days to send human beings to the moon. Therefore, basically, it was just faked for Cold War propaganda purposes. So anyway, it's quite an interesting thing to touch on. And the answer is, what's his name now? Satyavrata Prabhu, Stephen Rosen, based in the Manhattan, actually. He and I were talking about this once, and he actually, because of course he's an academic, he mixes with all kinds of people, spends a lot of time in the New York Library and so forth, talking to similar academics. And he's a bit touchy on this subject, because he said, you've got to be a bit careful what you say. People may misunderstand you and think you're crazy. But ultimately the conclusion is, it's not fundamental to devotee life or our devotional life whether they actually went to the moon or not. It's not really an important pressing matter for us. What we can say, however, is that the heavenly abodes exist in a way that is beyond our gross senses. Of that we can be sure. But everything else, conspiracy theories and things like that are not really our focus. They're not really fundamental to our spiritual life. Anyway, so it's all about consciousness, really, and practicing spiritual life, chanting the holy names, and in particular observing the recommendations, or the rules, if you like, as described by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So I'll stop there. If anyone has any comments or questions...